This room gets weirdly hot if you don't have the doors or the windows covered.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think we can actually control the heat, but it gets like really steamy.
Sweat lodge.
What are they all doing?
Oh, they're still talking about probes, I think.
Ah, jeez. Those syntacticians, they just love probing.
They're just fucking probing.
That's gotta go on my list of syntax bands to start. Probing for peepees.
You know some Dutch guy invented that term because no self-respecting English speaker or any speaker. Self-respecting English speaker would know the felicity evident in the world.
Well, maybe they're not self-respecting.
How was the craziest word I could get a whole bunch of
PPs?
Especially when you have a curse of PPs and PP.
Yeah. My ex-roommate, he always used to say whenever he saw one of those disabled license plates that says DP, he always thought of DP, DP. It's like, dude. And his mom had one of those, too.
That's brutal. Okay. That's
yeah. So. Handouts, and it's Lockout's fault because apparently the hacks guy used.
There's one, there's general guy, that's the one that's nice, you know, has the title and the line. And then I just put all the examples on this other sheet. So I put one of the senses, well, we'll talk about the senses later. Actually, no, let's go ahead and start with that. Let's talk about scrambling.
Let's talk about it.
You guys like it?
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
So you've heard about like pussy scrambling? Like
what?
No, I mean like put like baby scrambling, like
yeah.
I don't mean like actual.
I got you.
you don't mean putting cats in blenders.
Oh,
oh
yeah,
that's
that kind of cat. That just shows that you're still pure because I
yeah.
can't get to a sexual.
Wow, that should be a subtext band too. Oh damn, pussy scrambling.
Actually, I went with the one you went
with. Yeah. We're married.
I like my idea.
Yeah, I'm married. It's fine. Trevor. Not Trevor. Ryan.
Shame on you. Shame on me.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah.
20 Hail Marys.
So lots of languages, I think I say it here. So like languages like German have this, what I would call pussy scrambling, which is really just you take constituents and you move them around.
Yeah.
So yeah, don't need that. So that's like pussy scrambling because you don't actually mix the constituents up. The thing about basically every single Indo-European language, or at least the oldest ones, is that they have real, like, big nut scrambling where, like, you know. And, like, well, okay, so I have examples here. I actually wrote this out because it's such a good sentence. And this is just, like, normal Latin poetry or whatever. So red, in red here, this is, like, the canonical word order. So it's like, what slender boy?
Can we use like put subject verb object?
Yeah,
or
like
very
yeah.
basic.
Okay, so here the subject of the sentence is where this is like boy.
Oh, so that's
yep.
which boy?
So this
which
is
skinny boy.
This is an adjective, and this
yeah.
is, so this is who?
Whatever.
So this is an adjective modifying that, and then this is sort of I guess I mean it's. Ablative, but you can think of it as modifying perfusus. So this is like, what slender boy infused with liquid smells, odors. So this is the subject right here. So this is just normal. Oh, we haven't even gotten to the scrambling.
Well,
so
it's not that crazy. Perfusus is it's a parson.
Yeah, yeah. So this isn't surprising at all in Latin syntax.
Yeah,
it's just
I was surprised by the
I mean the Latin. You're tempted to gloss it literally because this is where we get odor from, and this is liquid. But it, you know, it's not exactly the same. So here is your object. So just you. Here's a prepositional phrase. Really, this means like with a lot of roses, with shitloads of roses. Literally, in much rose or whatever. Here's another prepositional phrase, so in a pleasant cave, that's what that says. And this is like urget, this is like urge, so this is the verb. I mean, it means like, so what slender boy...
The last one's the vocative.
Yeah, so this is the vocative, this is the girl's name. So what this says is like, okay, which slender boy with all the perfume is trying to seduce you in this cave with the roses? That's what it literally says. Okay, so this is a typical sentence of Latin,
yeah.
But this isn't actually the sentence. Who wrote this?
I think
Catullus.
It's Catullus.
Catullus.
Actually, though, now I'm not sure.
Okay, well, whoever, Catullus or hypothetical Latin writer, they didn't write it this way. This is like the canonical word order of the sentence. This is what we actually have. So, quis, oh, that's where we expected. Multa gracilis te puer. Rosa perfusus liquidis urget
sub is at the end.
Sub antro ato pura. So this is like real scrambling. But like everything is fucked up. Everything in this sentence like is just insane. This is like actual scrambling because
I think the term from the literature is something like hyperbaton.
Hyperbaton?
Hyperbatons, that's what they called it in Greek. Yeah,
really?
Hyperbatons, just like, just taking it and going.
Yeah. So when people say, yeah.
Can you say the meanings in the scrambled version?
Oh, yeah.
In order? I want to see.
Listen.
Oh, okay. So, who, mini, slender you, boy, in rose, infused liquids, urges, with odors, pleasant, pura, in the cave? That's...
You and if you look at the case marking, you'll see that, like, yeah. even if that made sense in a linear string, that's not, like, the... Those aren't the connections you're supposed to be making.
Yeah, it's...
That word that means much or many.
Musa.
With rose. It modifies the rose?
Yeah, so he goes here. So, you know, here's your prepositional phrase.
How could it happen?
But all prepositions, there are
many
complement follows
them.
Right.
So Latin, in that respect, Latin is very conservative.
Yeah.
We'll talk about this.
This was 4 years of high school for me.
Is muta an adverb or an adjective?
It's an adjective.
Sort of. It's declined, so it inflects for person and number, so it's sort of like
an
adjective. So this is marked for ablative case and feminine gender.
I'm wondering if the reason why you can't scramble or you don't scramble the prepositions is because they're very light, such that in rosa it's really one prosodic word.
I was gonna say possibly. And Latin is very conservative in that you do usually have prepositional phrases sort of together.
Yeah.
But we will look at, in a couple minutes, other Indo-European languages are not like that.
Right.
In fact, who even knows what prepositions are in Homeric Greek or Sanskrit?
This makes total sense to me. Like, this is just like classical Persian poetry.
Really?
Except that, like, the way much is away from rose, that doesn't make sense. Otherwise...
Everything else is fine, though.
Yeah, I can live with the rest.
I think I do have an invested example. We can look at... so the first... Number one... I guess Catullus or whoever, I'm not sure. The second example, that's the first line of the Aeneid, which isn't...
Oh, that one.
So this is, it's not quite as bad as this sentence, I think, if you actually parse it out, but, this is why when you learn Latin, once you start reading classical authors, you read Caesar, because Caesar's a very clear writer, he doesn't do any of this fancy stuff. All poetry is just totally scrambled, including the Aeneid, and I remember in high school, I was like, I'm gonna read the Aeneid today, and then I opened that shit up, and I was like, I got to this sentence, and I'm like, oh my god, what am I doing?
You mean the first sentence?
Yeah, I just opened it up, yeah. So this is real scrambling, and I was doing this so fast, some of the glossing's definitely bad. Number three is Avestan, and this is the first Avestan sentence I ever read, and it was a living nightmare, and that's not even my translation. Someone got through that sentence. It's just a So this one is so hard to even parse that I had to consult multiple sources for this, but and I'm not sure it's even actually right. But this is why when I studied Indo-European, this was Avestan was the language with like the craziest scrambling, and this takes the cake if you actually run through it. Because there's, and of course, in a language like Latin, all Indo-European languages, you know, you have a lot of inflections for number and case and gender, so you can sort of make heads or tails of this. But especially in this Avestan example, you have a lot of different genitives, you have a lot of totally different things. You know, you don't really have prepositional phrases. This was sort of Indo-European before prepositions or postpositions. You know, it's a living nightmare. Any comments on scrambling? You can go to the library right now and just pick up any poetry book in Latin and Greek, and you will get exactly this. These aren't cherry-picked examples. This is how people speak poetically.
So it's just in poetry.
We will look at later on. You do have certain types of scrambling all over the place, but it's not like these crossing dependencies. That's unique to poetry, but you are definitely way more flexible with what you can say and what order you can say them in. But we'll look at some examples later on of like more realistic. Yeah. So we're sort of, so on the other handout, we're sort of going through the syntax numbers, but that's not too important because everything's on the same. So number two, the prepositions thing. So the thing about, of course, in English we have prepositions and we have a couple things that are sort of postpositions, like ago, I guess, 10 years ago, sort of a postposition. In earlier Indo-European languages, everything gets a little fuzzier. Now Latin is a good example of, it's militantly prepositional, and as you guys noted, you do have sort of, you do have constituents here with the head and the head of the preposition. But outside of Latin, if you look at other languages, everything's just busted. It, actually, even in Latin, there are a couple salient examples of this. So for example, for whatever reason, if you want to say, you know, with him, you say cum eo, with him, very simple. If you want to say, you know, with, you know, a dog, whatever, very simple. But for whatever reason, in Latin, if you want to say with me, you say mecum. So this is sort of a remnant of where, you know, no one really knows, you know, where to put prepositions, or if they're prepositions with or not. And of course, in Spanish has a really key hold over this. So you say, yeah, so para mí, but you say conmigo. So migo comes from mecum, and it's just the form of me that we use in a preposition with diesels. So Latin, at least, it has these remnants, but it's pretty consistently prepositional. But let's look at these Greek examples because it's a little nutty. So in number four, epi, by the time we get to Koine Greek, by the time of Alexander and all this stuff, epi is a preposition. It's a preposition today in Greek if it still exists. But here, there's no prepositional phrase that goes with it. Epi functions just as a sentential modifier. So the sentence is, let the gods be witnesses thereupon. And thereupon is sort of a translation of what epi is supposed to be. It doesn't take any specific object, it just generally modifies the entire sentence. Same in five, so in, which is in, as you might think, and thereupon he sat to handle jars of honey. He didn't put it on anything, it is just a general modifier of the sentence. Now, additionally, when you do have them used more or less as prepositions, you don't see what you have. This is Homeric Greek. This all is Homeric Greek. It applies to Greek Vedic Sanskrit as well. In examples like six, you see that you don't actually have to have the preposition and its object. And here, we know it's functioning as a preposition because lance is inflected for dative case, and this preposition gives dative case by its nature. So there is some kind of syntactic relationship, but around is on a totally different, it's, you know, a totally different part of the sentence. So he threw his dear hand around the lance. So around is at the beginning of the sentence, lance is at the end. So that's a strange preposition. Most weirderest is what you have in 7 and 8, which it's just funny to think this actually exists. Well, a couple things. First off, these elements that become prepositions, we take this for granted as Indo-European speakers, but when you think about a lot of the prepositions, especially those that come through Latin, they function as prepositions and also as preverbs. So pre and preverb is also, you know, comes from a Latin, you know, preposition in. Well, some examples of in are from the preposition in, others are from the negation. Of course, in 7 gives you a good example. So, en here functions as a preverb. So you have enid essen, made fast in. And you also have it functioning as sort of a standalone sentential modifier at the beginning of the sentence. And you also have it functioning as a normal preposition. And the weird thing is all of these mean the same thing. They don't change. If you omitted one of these, the meaning of the sentence wouldn't change.
So what's the first one? How is it different from normal preposition? The first and
the second. So, well, okay, so the first one is sort of like what we have in 4 and 5. So it's just a general sentential modifier. You could think of it as something like 6. But the one at the end of the sentence, so in outdate, that's functioning as a canonical preposition, so that's a little different. And then you have the preverb as well. So you, and again, none of these change the meaning of the sentence per se. All of them contribute, they're all sort of, they're like copies that haven't been deleted, basically. They all mean the same stuff. They don't change anything. They're still there. Who knows why? So yeah, that's really weird. And the same is true in 8. You have N. N functions, again, as a sentential particle at the beginning, and you also have it used as a just standard preposition, and no change in the meaning of the sentence. It just means, you know, into the golden cup, and nothing else. And then 9, I didn't give any examples of Greek of this, but so these, so ambi in Sanskrit is the same as the preposition in 6 in Greek. Etymologically, they look a whole lot like. So here is just an example of it really functioning as, I guess, like what you have in German or other languages as a detached part of the verb. Because you have, in other situations, you might have it verb initial or at the beginning of the verb. In Sanskrit and other languages, they're detachable and stuff like that. So again, that can be compared to German. It can be compared to, you know, early Latin and stuff like that. So the moral of the story, generally, is that prepositions don't seem to exist in, you know, early Indo-European. They're just sentential modifiers, and they gradually become grammaticalized as prepositions or postpositions in different languages.
So how did they do it?
How did they communicate, or?
I'm in the house. I'm in the cave. How do you do that?
Well,
just case merging.
Well, you would use a locative there, so you would use locative case to say I'm in there or whatever. So that's the main. Well, you'd be surprised what you can communicate with just 8 cases. And then if you wanted to be specific, you would use one of these sentential modifiers to say specifically how. And apparently that's what eventually happened. People, you know, used them to the point that they became necessary. So, you know, that's sort of guesses to that. And at the same time, of course, the case system of Indo-European, which is, you know, 8, maybe more, maybe a little less cases, gradually becomes reduced in pretty much in every single family. So you'll have more marginal cases, like the locative in Latin merges with the ablative and the instrumental. So those are all sort of marginal cases. They all merge together. Or usually everything merges with the dative, and you'll have, like, you know, nominative, accusative, dative, and genitive, where dative is like all the other 5 cases. So yeah, that's case and prepositions for you. So I challenge anyone to go read this kind of poetry. I mean, like, there's so many, it was hard for me to find sentences for this because there are so many sentences that people don't even know the meanings of, because, you know, we know what all the words in them mean,
yeah.
But it's because, you know, there's so much ambiguity and there's all this sentential modification, it's just a mess. Like, you know, it's hard to get a good gloss for a lot of this stuff. Indo-European is super famous, section 3. Indo-European is super famous for having second position in everything. Like, there's just, I mean, they use second position phenomena to, you know, really ad nauseum. It's in basically every language family in some reflex. At a basic level, languages like Latin and Greek, you know, in Sanskrit and all these other things, have clicks that are universally second position. So if you actually look at all the Greek sentences I already gave you, like 6 through 9 and all that, there's this little, well, not all of them, but in 6 you have it, and I think in 5 and, yeah, 4 and 5.
Yeah, 7 and 8. 2 is just that it's, like, the size.
Oh, yeah. So you see a cliticized dead. That's just a discourse marker. It's a sentential clitic. The translation, of course, varies. I gloss it as thus, but it could be thus and but, whatever. The same thing is true of yo in the Sanskrit example of nine. And I give you a Latin example, alpen in pen. So in all of these situations, you have these clitics, which universally are the second constituent in the sentence. You have them in Gothic, you have them in Old Church Slavic, you have them everywhere. They're just everywhere. And they're a very productive, and keep in mind, while you can scramble everything else, I mean, it's like Walpuri or any of those languages, you can scramble everything in the sentence, but you just keep the second position stuff where it belongs.
Is it second, like after the first constituent or after the first word?
It's the second word, right, usually?
I think it can be both. I think it depends on the circumstance. I think usually, I feel like in Latin it's usually the first word, but I'm not 100% sure.
So the thing that precedes the second position click?
So you want to say like John's yes. uncle something, and then you can put something between John and uncle?
That would be weird.
Yeah, I'm
John's.
Well, I think there are a couple situations of I'm trying to. It depends on which language you'd have to look it up to be sure.
It is often like a single word. I think it can be like a whole phrase constituent. But if it is, if it's anything bigger than a word, it has to be like a whole phrase constituent.
Yeah.
Like you can't just have kind of shit in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's typically a single word.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My intuition is that it's a single word in Latin. I can't. In Greek, probably as well. I think.
Yeah.
I think there is some debate whether it goes, because I think in some situation it actually goes on the, it's enclitic and proclitic. I always get those confused.
Yeah.
Which one's which?
Proclitic means comes before.
Okay. I think there are some examples of it being enclitic on the second word, so that would basically make it the third.
Yeah, the third.
Yeah. I've heard third. Third.
Yeah. So that apparently is a thing, but I don't think that's as common. So just in clitics, and keep in mind not all of them are phonetically reduced. So alpen is two syllables. It you know has some kind of it's not just nothing. Although you do have it in cliticized or procliticized in Greek here. So yeah, those are just all over the place in Indo-European. And we have every reason to think that they're actually even more common at an archaic level because of Hittite. So Hittite, there's an example in 11, which is a good example of something we don't totally know how to gloss. We don't know what all of those clitics actually mean. But the clitics Hittite has what's called clitic chains because they love clitics so much you will have like five clitics in every single sentence. And they'll just all be stacked up next to each other right after the first word. So here you have, you know, we don't exactly know what this is, but it says at least, but his son himself to him. So you have a dative clitic marking him, and then you have you know a clitic, an emphatic clitic marking the son. And just as a note, whenever you see Hittite glossed, and I think this applies to other languages, if you see something that's all capital, that means it's a cuneiform thing that we haven't deciphered. We know the meaning, we don't know how it's pronounced. So that's what dumu is. It means son, but we don't know how it's pronounced. Yeah, I think the first part of the handout is actually on Anatolian, so we can go ahead. We can actually skip to that right now. So, just as a reminder, all Indo-European languages except for Hittite and Tocharian were known about in the 19th century. And I think Hittite was actually, I think people knew that there was Hittite stuff out there, but no one had, I'm going to look this up. There's this really good, the sentence that people deciphered Hittite from. This is a good one. Hold on. We have to. Hold on. Decipher. Because it is such a good. I'll erase the board while I'm looking for it.
Did you drink this to have energy?
I don't know. It was like a dollar. I didn't know it lives on it.
Yeah, I got tired of drinking coffee, so I wanted to sleep it out.
You don't need energy, you have it. Mushroom.
Correct. I gotta find this.
English is mostly spoken outside of England.
Anatolia is the region also known as Russia's Asia Minor.
Yeah. We're also in Persian. Not Asia Minor, but Osiris Salim.
I think I'm almost there. Oh, I got it. This is such a good sentence. Because this guy, this fucker got so lucky. So the guy who deciphered Hittite, like, okay, this kind of linguistics would never pass for in the real world. This fucker just got so lucky. So this, I don't know how to pronounce his name because it's Eastern European. Bedrich Hronsny? Something like that? I'll write.
Well, he wasn't lucky enough to have a name that is.
Yeah, so I don't even know what language this is. Bohemia. He's from Bohemia, so he might be Czech or something. Czech. Okay, so I'm gonna write this. This fucker got so. I'm so pissed that, like, if I could find something like this. This red is running out. Yeah, no, he wasn't even. I mean, I'm sure he was a bright young scholar, but this guy just got so lucky when he found the sentence. So here's the sentence he found. So, Ninda, this is capital, so we still don't know how this is pronounced. And then it has an ending on here. And then, where'd it go?
So they knew what the cuneiform characters sound like, right?
Yeah, so that has been known. We knew already, I forget who deciphered them within the modern times, but by the time we're looking at Sanskrit, we already knew how to decipher Akkadian and these other sort of cuneiform languages, so we could figure out, you know, what these. And keep in mind, it's something like Chinese, where part of it is ideographic, part of them have meanings, and then part of them are. They're phonetic. I'm trying to. Okay, here it is. Let me just write this. I'm so pissed. This guy just got. I know it is. So everything in lowercase is phonetic, and then this thing up here, this means this was an ideogram, and it means bread, I think. So.
And this was also known.
Yeah. This he figured out. Okay. Well, this is just the cuneiform symbol for bread. So let's assume that that's actually the word for bread. We don't know how it's pronounced. But here's what he said. Hey, just 1 second. So here's what he realized. Any Indo-Europeanist would see this immediately. Oh shit, there's an N. That's like the accusative marker in Latin and Greek and Sanskrit. In every language, this is obviously an accusative marker.
So this should be eaten.
Yeah. Yeah, so this one. It's in teni, it's a teni. Yeah, so this is like SN in German, this is like edere in Latin. This is obviously eat, this is obviously some form of eat. Ends up this will be the second plural, so that's like a eat bread. Next word, watar, what the fuck is that? I fucking wonder what this word is. This is a good example of a RN stem. These are, water I think is one of English's only examples of an RN stem, but they're the one of the oldest noun forms in Proto-Indo-European. We didn't know that until we discovered Hittite and found them all over the place. But so here's water. Here's another accusative ending. And I think ma, in this situation, it's a negation particle. Let me double check. Oh, wait, no, I just wrote it twice. Oops. And then the best part, so this eku, he was like, what does that remind me of? You know what that looks like? It looks like aqua in Latin. Maybe these are related. And this fucker was right. Like, so this is drink. So
So the sentence is like, you know, and you eat bread and drink water. And from there, you know, you have your endings, you have sound correspondences, so you know, edere is going to be, in Latin, is going to be like, well, I guess edere is late at Latin, it's technically esse, but, so this is going to be equivalent. So you have you already have your sound correspondences, you already have all your bass, you have the ending, oh my god, this guy got so fucking
great.
Lucky.
And how, why do you say this guy was lucky? Didn't other people have access to the
I'm sure they do. I mean, I'm sure a gajillion people looked over this, but it's just this sentence. I mean, you know, when you're actually deciphering something, it's like there's so many variables and there's so many.
You don't know which sentence to look at.
Exactly. So this.
You don't even know what's a sentence, right? You just see a bunch of little squiggles on the line.
Yeah. So.
Well, he wasn't just lucky. I mean, there's something there.
Like there is, but that's. I mean, that's what's so funny about it because the guy. I mean, like, you know, if I go to try and decipher some text I think that might be Indo-European, I'm probably going to overshoot what is actually in, like, oh, this word looks like, you know, something for doll or something like that. And so you see patterns that aren't there, and that's probably what he was doing. He was seeing all these patterns, but in this sentence he was right. Like, all of the, this sentence is perfect to decipher a language. And he,
nice.
So, that's, this is the first.
Very nice.
The first one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I say that he's the luckiest guy ever, but no, I'm sure there a lot of shit went into this.
Yeah.
So, but this is like a golden.
So, we don't know for word for bread that that's how it's pronounced.
Yeah.
Are the capital letters sort of assumed because according to sound correspondents are kind of going back, or why aren't we just writing like
the Hittites didn't invent cuneiform, so is this a logogram borrowing from?
So Ninda, I think, would be the Akkadian word for bread.
Oh,
yeah.
That's why we write it like that.
So it may actually sound nothing. Like
yeah,
it could
be anything.
So definitely it didn't actually.
Yeah.
It's very unlikely that Hittites and Akkadian had the same
yeah.
word for bread.
Yeah. Although they do actually. Well, one of them. Well, I guess we're talking about Anatolian, so it's perfect for it to come up. So Hittite. So most other Indo-European languages share. I mean, you know, Hittite of course shares all this vocabulary with everything else. But the interesting thing is that Hittite, while other languages share words for like field and plow and wheat and I don't know about wheat, but you know, different kind of farming terms, Hittite doesn't have them. So this is one of the gajillions of reasons we know that Hittites left first, because what happened is that the Hittite group left, they settled in Anatolia, they get their words for farming from, you know, the Akkadians or whoever the hell's around, and everyone else, you know, farming apparently moves through that area, and everyone else, you know, has words that we can reconstruct for plow or whatever. So that's what do I have? So I think that's one of the so the exception to all the rules that I told you. Are you
so what happened to Hittite? I mean, why doesn't it have any descendants alive?
Well, we don't exactly know when Hittite died. It could have been the Persians, it could have been the Greeks, it could have been, you know, we have all these old texts. We know they at least survive. Well, the thing is, we have old texts, we don't have really new texts. Because once the Hittite Empire fell, it was no longer a productive, you know, people weren't writing in it anymore. So we don't know how long the language survived after that, I don't think. Of course, I said, I think, a couple times ago that the Trojans were probably speakers of Luwian, an Anatolian language. So they were at least around until then. But generally, they just faded into nothingness, as did probably a lot of other Indo-European language families.
And in what form do we have the texts? Are they, like, tablets?
So pretty much everything from that period, I think, is tablets. Again, they're written in cuneiform form. And we actually have, I think,
Is there older than Vedic Sanskrit texts?
Yes.
In what form do we have the Vedic Sanskrit?
Well, Vedic is an interesting situation because I don't know how. The same is true of Homeric Greek. Vedic Sanskrit is a very archaic form of the language, and at some point they're written down. I'm not entirely sure in what form. But it's clear that the language.
that is used in those texts precedes the time that it's written at. So I'm not sure what our first physical evidence of Sanskrit or Greek is, or I think I have it wrote in the first handout or something. But it's clear that the language is like 1,000 or so years. Like this, it's part of an oral tradition that just got written down in this period. So same is true of Greek.
I think Avestan is also like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't know the specifics, but.
Yeah, it's written, like the written forms we have are written by people who didn't speak it, and they made errors in writing.
Well, it can be very useful when people make errors in writing things typographically.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you about everyone's languages. My good old Jerry Klein back at UGA, he's the historical linguist there. He actually he made a famous. So anyone ever heard of the Georgia Guide Studies? So it's a funny story. Like in the middle of a park, I don't know why I'm getting up to draw this, but well anyway, there are these little stones. They're actually pretty big. So there's this park in Georgia, and there's a meadow or whatever, an opening. And then someone, a couple of decades back, commissioned to have these giant stone pillars built. And, they look shit like this. They're sort of like square-ular or something like that. I mean, you can look them up. They're called the Georgia Guide Stones. But no one knows who built them. No one knows who commissioned them. But whoever did it had on every side a message written in a different language. And it's like, how to... It's supposed to be like, everyone in the world dies, how do we rebuild, how do we live life with each other, stuff like that. So it's like really sort of creepy, and like every once in a while people will deface it with like, fuck the Illuminati or whatever, that kind of shit. But my advisor, good old Jerry Klein, he was commissioned to write on the top a message in Greek and one in Sanskrit. So he actually wrote the messages on it. He has no idea who employed him. Someone just came by the department and was like, I need someone to translate this into Greek and Sanskrit. So, yeah, it was just creepy. So, but anyway, he made some kind of typographical error that he always talks about. Like, and he was always like, oh, well, first off, he was talking historical linguists, them. He was talking about how he specifically chose every word. So, like, if all of the world's linguistic corpus is evaporated, you can still use his Greek and Sanskrit examples and you can tell that they're related, because he's using conjugate, cognate form.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he made some typographical errors that, illustrate his native language, and that's why I thought of that. Yeah, it wasn't. That's the definition of story growth. So, I guess two of you guys weren't here last week. So Indo-European has all these tenses and aspects. Hittite doesn't. let's see, where was I? So first off, Anatolian doesn't have thematic verbs. So thematic verbs, we talked about last time, are the most productive form of, they're just a root plus a thematic vowel plus an ending. And most Indo-European verbs are constructed like that. There are archaic verbs that have no thematic vowel. They're just called athematic verbs. And those dominate Anatolian. You don't have any other examples. So that's another check. So Anatolian must be archaic from this.
It's like French has verbs that are ERs and IRs. Spanish has A, E, I, R, plus something like that.
Yeah, sort of like that. And, in other languages, so in languages like Latin, we know Latin is recenter because when you learn Latin, you have your aure, you have your ede, you have ide, you have all these different conjugations. There are maybe two or three, so there are a couple Latin verbs. So esse, meaning be, this is athematic. Esse, meaning eat, this is athematic. And then fere, a couple others, this means bear. So,
pose.
So pose is sort of a derivative of esse. I'm trying to think. There are a couple others. So, like in Latin, you have like four or five athematic verbs, and that's normal. But Hittite has them all over the place.
These are athematic we know this just by looking at the infinitive, or
because they're irregular in conjugation.
Yeah. So like normally, Latin infinitives will end in like are, or you'll always have some kind of vowel here. In these situations, you actually reconstruct these to being es plus re. Re is just the general infinitive ending in Latin. Same thing here. And then these actually, Latin has a very productive system of rhoticization where, like, basically every intervocalic or, you know, different. I said this backwards. Sorry. No, these are the underlying forms. So the actual infinitive ending in Latin in every situation, underlyingly, is se, every situation. Even though basically every Latin verb has an re, r ending or whatever, and that's because intervocalic s's are vocalized to r in Latin universally across. This is the real Latin, even though 99% of Latin verbs end in re.
I think there's something similar about Germanic. I think Gothic actually preserves. So in Germanic, you have lots of R's, but then in Gothic, a lot of them are Z's.
Yeah, and that especially happens in Norse and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So Norse has all these R, you know, their nominative singular is just R.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be S, you know?
Yeah.
That's what it's supposed to be, but. So rhoticization, and Sanskrit actually does it too. I mean, it's actually really weird because you expect like an intermediary stage phonetically, like you expect maybe a Z there. But we actually have good evidence. This is I'm trying to think of the name. So that some early Roman author says, actually tells us, we don't have, basically tells us when this phonetic change happened, S to R, because he was talking about a guy who had to change his name. Something like, you know, Caecius or something like that. And he had to change his name to Caerius because everyone was saying that or something like that. I forget exactly what it is. So we know when this phonetic change happened.
And how do people get to R from an S?
See, that's the thing.
Response.
Yeah. Well, it's free. Who knows? I mean, it must go through. So, I don't know. Z is an intermediary. I mean, it's weird because this change happens in so many Indo-European language families. It might just be that at some level, R is just the underlying voiced equivalent of S. Like, in none of these languages do you have a Z as an independent phoneme. So it might just be that these two, you know, share the same kind of phonemic space.
Like in the Arabic script, they look similar. There's just a difference between them. And I never understand why should these two look similar. They don't have any relationship.
I'm still just as clueless. All I can say is this change happens all the time. So, especially in Indo-European languages. Also, ra is like so. I mean, the idea of R is so ambiguous. It's totally different. What
R is definitely a social construct.
R, yeah, that is R.
Yeah.
Yeah. Until the end, it's
R is a system. Yeah.
I
believe it.
Yeah.
Of course.
So again, so Anatolian lacks many inflectional categories. It doesn't. I guess you guys weren't here for this, but they don't have the perfect state of category. They don't have the subjunctive and future category. They don't have the aorist. They don't have the optative. All of these different tenses, they just totally lack. And that's basically all of Indo-European besides the perfect and the imperfect. The only interesting note we talked about last week, there used to be a stative class in Indo-European, which became the perfect and is also historically related to the mediopassive. In Hittite has two different conjugations. One of them is called the mi, the me conjugation, and this is clearly equivalent to all other normal Indo-European languages. So in Greek, mi is the standard first person singular ending. This is the first person singular of this ending.
So this is equivalent to every other language. And you have me and you have he, the he conjugation. And this, even though it looks, I mean, it functions just as a different conjugation, just as a different set of endings, it looks just like the Indo-European stative. So it's probably the case that, you know, you had some kind of stative class in early Indo-European, but, you know, at some point in time, Hittite family broke off and it developed in its own conjugation. And, of course, the semantics of it changed in later Indo-European languages into the perfect, like stuff we talked about before. So, again, more sort of proofs of oldness. Anatolian has no trace of duals. That's not too crazy, but, you know, the dual might have been... this might be because it was lost in Anatolian. That would be weird. It could also be that the dual only arose at a later state. And I guess we sort of talked about the ergative ending. So Anatolian has this ending that goes on neuters, and neuters take have to take ergative case to these subjects. And then, yeah, I just mentioned the empty conjugation. So all of those things together indicate quite clearly that Anatolian is different. And again, so there are some people who sort of dislike the idea of calling Hittite Proto-Indo-European, and they want to say, so you really have Proto-Indo-European, and that becomes Germanic, and that becomes Romance, and you know, Indo-Aryan. And you really should say that Anatolian is... Anatolian, whatever. You know how to spell it. I always spell Hittite Hittai when I'm typing. Yeah, it seems natural. So some people say, yeah. So some people say, you know, Anatolian is different enough to not be included in this family. And you should really... Yeah, you should really say, okay, it's not Indo-European, but there's another language family, Indo-Hittite, which is, you know, really... Yeah, so... And the thing is, when you think about Hittite not having all these things, it's hard to do the comparative method when you have, like, one odd man out. It's just sort of annoying. Like, a lot of people would like to construct this language more than this language. Second position stuff.
Yep. Second position stuff.
Let's that was a big closing bracket.
Okay, let's do this.
Yeah, back up over here. So yeah, second position lytics, you have them all over the place. I'm just erasing this. So this, I have a bunch of data from Hawk's Principles of Historical Linguistics, because it gives a very good case study of syntactic change. And this is like you have some pretty good examples that I've reproduced here. So one of the things you might want to ask yourself, just generally, is that how the hell does an SOV language become an SVO language, or vice versa, or anything like that? And Hawk gives this very good account of the historical change from SOV. So I'm just going to leave that up there.
Sure.
Indo-Hittite instead.
Yeah, it deserves it.
So early Indo-European canonically was probably SOV. Of course, you have all scrambling and flux everything out. But it was canonically probably SOV. Now, if you look at runic inscriptions, so the runic inscriptions, the earliest examples we have of Germanic, they're not, I don't think there's any, even necessarily a language that we know have a title. You know, we just have inscriptions. It's obvious these languages are Germanic. We don't know how to classify them.
Are they like ancestors of all of the Germanic languages we know, or are they just somewhere along the way from Proto-Germanic to some of these languages?
Well, I think in a lot of situations the evidence is just so scanty, you don't really know. Germanic is a sad story. Yeah, it's yeah, it's just fun stories. So Germanic is divided, I think, into three general subfamilies.
North, yeah.
West.
Yeah, that's right.
So East, the only language in the East family is Gothic. But there was...
Germanic.
Yeah, Gothic is very dead. It's also the first language that's actually tested in the Germanic family.
There's a lot of archaic traits.
Yeah. So Gothic doesn't have a umlaut. That's one of the good things. So everyone a umlaut.
Can we just go over it in 5 sentences?
Okay, so, well,
our examples.
We can talk about good old photis or whatever. So, you know, classic example, where do irregular English plurals come from?
Oh, no.
So you have at some archaic level,
yeah, and then
fote,
and then the e.
So you tack on
is.
Now, if you apply, so at some level, this was fronted, or, yeah.
Yeah, the.
Fetis, or, well, it's going to be rounded still. So this becomes Fetis. And if you apply the normal phonetic changes of Germanic, you will lose final Zs in English, and you will lose final Es in English. So you're left with Fet and Fotis. And of course, this becomes on, and of course, you have the crown.
What do you mean you're left with Fet and Fotis?
Oh, sorry, I meant to eliminate that too. So the
Fet and Fot, right?
Fet and Fot, yeah.
Yeah, and while you're losing the key, it lengthens the vowel, right?
Not
is
this.
Is there compensatory lengthening?
No, no. Compensatory lengthening only happens when they're part of the same syllable and you lose a coda. So there's no.
Those are round, I mean, length in general English, so it's full to fans, but I mean, I don't know.
Well, they were.
They
should.
Oh, they were underlining? Oh,
yeah, yeah, they.
Yeah,
so, sorry. Cares about the
if anything, foot is the one that is short. No.
Yeah. So umlaut is all over every Germanic language. It's all over a bunch of. They're very good examples of Romanian umlaut. I think I did a paper on this. Yeah. So
umlaut is just the remnant of some vowel harmony.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, umlaut it. It really just is vowel harmony. It's just umlaut is the word you happen to give it in Germanic linguistics.
But there is the weird thing that the vowel that triggered the harmony is not there anymore.
Yeah, so now it's historically gone. But even synchronically at this, even at a level, if you had still fotis, fetis, you would still call this umlaut. I think a lot of people will use it like that, but it really just means vowel harmony. And it's usually fronting, that should also be said.
It's a Germanic trait, right?
Is the,
yeah, but it's all over the place.
Is the vowel change for transitivity in English words also like sit, set, rise, raise?
That is ablaut. So remember, that would be, you know, so you would have like Indo-European, you know, something like this. Have a lengthening grade or something like that. So those would be different. So sit, this would come from, this would give us sit because that becomes data. And then, so this would be C, I'm trying to think. So set would come from, it'd be ablaut somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure.
So what's ablaut?
It's what we talked about last week. So in those situations, you can reconstruct the irregularity in English plurals all the way back to Indo-European. So it comes from that ablaut system that, you know, varies from null to E to O to, yeah, from that. So with those words like that are simp.
And they were just triggered by the laryngeals, right?
Yeah, by
laryngeals.
These are not triggered by laryngeals. This is the default ablaut of Indo-European. The other alternation we talked about that was schwa with long a, with long o, with long e, that is the one that comes arise from laryngeals. So it's an interaction of this alternation with that alternation. Yeah. And I have to correct myself because I just realized I said something wrong. Sit and set is not ablaut. I take that back. It is a different, there is a special Indo-European ending, a factative ending, that I think would cause that vowel change. I think it might still be ablaut. I'll have to look it up. I don't know.
But this is drunk, right?
Drink, yeah. So, so drink, so drunk is zero grade. So this comes from that. So this would be drink. And or drink. Yeah, so that comes from, and that's just normal today. Oh, and I guess I should show you guys like a little bit of a contrast example from English. So this gives you sit, right? This gives you sat. This gives you seat. This gives you sit. And guess what this gives you? You two don't know. Guess what this? So S and T with nothing in between them. Can you think of a word? It's so good. You would never think of this. It involves sitting. Okay. Nest. So this is a really good example of an ablaut alternation, which is still captured in modern English. So nest, sit, sat, seat, soot.
What does soot mean?
Soot is like that, like ash or
ash. It sits at the bottom of the fireplace.
Is it soot or
soot? Soot,
soot.
Like the upside down horseshoe.
Okay. Upside down horseshoe. You can't just say upsilon. That's totally
interesting.
So the upside down, I mean,
it's an upside down horseshoe.
This is just Latin upsilon, guys.
No, it's not.
Latin upsilon.
I like Brian's it.
What do you mean? Yep, that's
what it's not upsilon.
Ask Siri someone.
You
there's
guys.
Latin upsilon. It's Greek upsilon.
Yeah, I guarantee you that's what it's called.
Well, let's yell at the frat guy down there.
I know
the alphabet, forwards and backwards.
I know the Greek alphabet too.
Yeah, it's Latin upsilon. I'm telling you, dog.
Latin upsilon. I've never heard of this.
Is that Wikipedia? That's what it's called. I don't know.
Called Latin upsilon is the letter of the. Well, it's formed. Okay. That's
it?
Weird. So it is derived from Greek.
Yeah.
Look
anything like.
Well, it's sort of, I mean, in certain writings of it,
still.
At certain periods, you know. It's like how some people write sigma like this.
I like the horseshoe.
Yeah, but horseshoe's a good one. I think I usually call it horseshoe. I think that's what most people
call
it.
Okay,
moving
right along.
Oh, yes, we were talking about word order, that's what.
Yeah, that's exactly
what were we?
We were about to talk about how. Okay, so this is totally part of second position phenomena. So, you know, everyone know Walker Noggle. Okay, so there's a tendency, and this is part of what the sentential clitics are about. There's a tendency of unemphasized sentential modifiers to move to second position in all of these, in all languages in the world. That's just where discoursey stuff goes. Okay. So in 12 and 13 we have runic inscriptions, and actually the translations are not super clear because we don't know that much about this language, whatever it is. But 12 means something like he is menaced by evil spirits, where flagda is evil spirits, and the verb comes after menaced is. So that's your word order. Very clearly SOV, and it's not in a subordinated clause, it's not like German or something.
Sure.
Just
we don't know if it's passive or not.
It is passive. So it is menaced. Menaced is a past participle.
Oh.
So the same is true in 13, so he was destined for the throes. I don't know what that means in modern English, but that's what you do when you don't know how to translate something. You use a word
no one knows
what
the arcane word.
What does it mean? That's exactly the problem.
I think it means. I feel like it means like Hades or something. I don't know.
It's some kind of chaotic something. I have a sense of what it means, but I have no way to describe it.
It's just
my deep Germanic blood.
Yeah. Today it only ever gets used in like idiomatic.
Yeah.
Anyway, SOV.
Pain before death.
We have a very clear SOV structure here. Everything where it should be. Now, in early English, you have second position phenomena all over the place. And one of the things that gets moved to second position is auxiliary verbs.
Yeah.
So in 13, or 14, 15, and 16, But in those two, so you have to Beowulf was battle glory given. So is or was, you know, should in the abstract be at the end of the sentence. That's where it's quote unquote base generated.
If you believe that stuff.
And then, you know, it moves up to C or whatever, you know, what have you. You know, like good old German or something. So this is, you know, just moving clitics up to Wackernagel position. It's nothing too special. But eventually in 16, you see that V2 gets generalized to non-clitic, non-auxiliary verbs. So we have lots of examples in post-Beowulf days of just all main verbs, all, you know, conjugated verbs moving up to C. So we know another island east of here. So that's what we have in 16, and that's what we have all over the language. Now, eventually, the last step, since we're gradually moving things up, is speakers start reinterpreting sentences like 16 instead of being underlyingly SOV with some transformations. They interpret English as being an SVO language. So that's what you have in 17, and that's what you have in every modern English sentence. So the Lord was speaking these words to Moses. So that's a normal SVO sentence. You have both your verbs where an SVO sentence should be. So that is a step-by-step account of how word order has changed in Germanic languages, and the same thing happens in Slavic languages, and to some extent Romance languages. So they're all SVO nowadays. And we have good data from all of, you know, from the history of these languages, and they all show the same thing. Originally, auxiliary verbs become cliticized and move up, then you have all verbs in the language.
Sorry, what time is the Beowulf? Like 8th century, 9th century?
Yeah. I mean, it's another example of one of those things that was written a lot before, or was in the...
Well, the thing with Beowulf is that it was probably originally written in another dialect of English, and then it was transcribed into what was called the Westminster Standard, which was a variety of... that variety was the standard version of the language, and it eventually became the West Country dialects of English, which are like universally maligned in England, despite the fact that they're actually the like direct descendants of the language that Beowulf was written in. But anyway, yeah, so it was probably written in a Northumbrian dialect, but it was transcribed into the Westminster Standard by monks working at the Abbey.
So and it's a good example of something that's clearly oral tradition, because it's not set in England or whatever, you know.
Right.
And you know,
set in like continental Europe.
It's Denmark.
Beowulf himself is a Geat.
Weird.
In the story. Yeah.
How many years was it after the immigrations of the?
Couple hundred.
The tradition or the belief is that Beowulf was in fact written in England, like originally composed.
After
the migration.
Yes, but it was part of an oral tradition.
Yeah. For how many centuries were they carrying their continental Europe?
Not a ton, probably.
Compared with the Rig Veda, it's not crazy to have.
It's kind of an interesting story because it's clearly, so if you read Beowulf, you'll see huge amounts of like reference to Christianity.
Yeah.
It's very clear that
place,
was put
out
in
place
later. It's very clear that this is like a fully heathen story. Like it just oozes heathen values, like old Germanic values, you know, battle glory.
Yeah.
And then you just say battle glory for God. That's basically how it's written.
Yeah.
It's like all this like personal glory to what?
Well, that's personal glory to Shakespeare.
The Edda is great. Snorri Sturluson, the guy who wrote him down. He has a little preface. This is what they used to believe, but we all know that the real star of the universe is God writing down.
Yep.
That's life.
So old English.
I mean, as far as Germanic languages go, the three Hudsons are Gothic, Old English, and Old Norse. So those are by far the oldest languages we have good records on. Because even though Old English isn't super old, it's a lot older than the other Germanic stuff. So.
Yeah, because the writing that the Franks and the Continental Saxons and the Alemann were doing in Latin.
Yeah. And I remember, I was going to get to a sad story about Germanic.
Yeah, it's
sad. You guys have so much content, you know. I'm happy about it.
So,
closing this bracket.
Sure.
I was talking about, I'm not even going to remember what the language is.
I'm going to have to look this up. No, it's I forgot what I know what the language is.
For a language. That is like, fuck you, language. We're calling you, giving you the most boring name ever.
Actually, it's not boring. It's odd.
Yeah.
Odd is not boring.
It sounds...
It's technical.
But it sounds like sort of...
like what you put in a file cabinet.
It sounds deep and... I don't know. It just sounds like... I don't know. It sounds like a mysterious language.
They should call it Mysterious Church Salon.
Yeah. I wanted to share one anecdote about Germanic.
I've got time.
Does anyone have time constraints?
No.
Not before, 4:45 or whatever?
Okay.
It's 3:45.
Yeah, so we have an hour.
Yeah, we've got some time.
Stories are too long.
Yes, let's...
Okay, yeah, it's not... I think... Was it Burgundian? Was it Burgundian? Shit.
Slavonic?
Okay, well... I'm just gonna tell it. I don't remember the name of this language. It was some kind of Germanic language. But here's the deal, huh?
And this is like, you know, one of those like epic parts of history that you're just like, I mean, it's like the burning of the Great Library. You're like, oh shit, so close. So there was this one. Okay, I'm gonna look it up. I'll tell you next week.
Next week for us.
Yeah, we're like, we're going to Paris.
Oh yeah,
and it's. Next week is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
You gotta do it now.
Wait, what time are you leaving?
Oh, we're leaving on Sunday morning.
Shit, okay. I'm gonna look this up.
You guys keep talking. You guys tell,
Talk about how Persian works.
Persian doesn't work.
So it's the same as every other language.
How does Kurdish work? It does work.
It does. It works beautifully.
Kurdish works
has
a lot.
So...
You guys, you know nothing about Kurdish. You're just gonna find stuff.
We know bits of Kurdish and like grammatical facts, but like we are not speakers of this language.
Yeah. What are you eliciting? Just say words, Mr. Kurdish speaker person.
Yes.
And I'll figure
say
out.
Say words and say sentences.
And then does this sentence sound okay in Kurdish?
So you have someone who's gonna.
We have Persian language sentences, and these particular people, at least the ones in France, know Persian. So we will, I guess the idea is we will feed them sentences of Persian and say, does this kind of sentence work in your language?
Okay. That's going to
be fun. How
would you say it?
See, yeah, I mean, it was really, we did a practice session this weekend. It was really easy because, one, our informant knew English as well. So I could also, I mean, I know some Persian, but not enough to
make
like, keep
judgment.
Going. Yeah, keep
although
going.
You impressed her.
Yeah. Well, that was mostly probably my pronunciation.
Yeah, that's the trick. You just say like, "Hi, how are you? I would like some tea. Thank you." Oh shit.
Okay, I am gonna. I cannot find it on the internet, so I'm gonna call my friend real quick because I have to remember this. I have to remember this fucking language's name. Hello? Hi. I'm having one of those tip of the tongue states. Can you tell me what the name of that language that was elicited at a dinner party, like the Germanic one? What was that?
Crimean Gothic.
Crimean Gothic. Oh, yes. Okay. Oh my god, thank you. That feels so good. What? Okay. Well, what's up with you?
No time for this.
No. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, thanks for that. I really needed to know that. Yeah. I'll keep in touch. Bye. Bye. Okay, so Crimean Gothic, spoken in the Crimea, or dead now. So here's the deal. This language was... It's an East Germanic language like Gothic, obviously. It's a form of Gothic. And it survived hundreds of years past Gothic. I want to look up how... Crimean Gothic. Oh my god. I didn't know it was that. Jesus Christ. Okay, wow. It's even... So here's the deal. Gothic, what, was spoken... When were the Goths around? There were maybe as late as 500 or something like that. So Crimean Gothic was a language that was existing somewhere in Eastern Europe for long periods of time. No one knew any fucking idea that there were too many people out there. And it eventually went extinct around the 17th century. So it's out there. No one had any idea. Here's the deal. There was some king out east who was interested in linguistics or language or something like that, and he found the very last speaker of Crimean Gothic.
Wow.
In the 17th century. I don't know how old he was or whatever. So the only information we have about Crimean Gothic, I mean, this is just like, this
pretty
is
awesome.
Yeah, you want to find some shit like this. If only we could find this a Hittite or Tumerian or something, that'd be great. But so the guy invited this old guy who spoke some Crimean Gothic to his dinner party, and he just elicited every word he can think. I mean, he just, hey, what's the word for cup? What's the word for glass? What's the word for chicken? Like, just shit that was just, you know, sitting at the table or whatever. So it's just like, this is, like, all we have from this language, and it's like, I don't know, it's just one of those verge of history moments that...
And we have all the lists that he created?
Yeah, it's still there, and that's the craziest thing. It's, you know, the East Germanic language family survived for a millennium past Gothic. No one had any idea until someone found this last fucker and elicited some shit from him. So, and it's not a good professional elicitation. It's not like, you know, looking for irregular verbs or
not looking for scrambling.
Not looking for scrambling.
Wow, I guess it's expensive.
Not any that trace effects. So you can't do that. That was my friend who had his theory about uvulars. He's into Germanic languages a lot. So.
Nice.
Okay, so where are we? Okay.
We're in the filling up specifiers.
Okay, we're in the clear. So.
Yeah, we've got a closed bracket.
Yeah, another closed bracket. Let's open up a couple more. Right. So let's fill up some specifiers. So Latin has. So it's actually a little weird, right? So you have prepositional phrases in the abstract, at least in the X-bar theory. You know, you have these specifiers. Why don't you fill them up with something? You know, that's what I'm thinking. So Latin has a very productive way of filling up prepositional specifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you all know phrases like summa cum laude, magna cum laude.
Yeah, we all know.
You never heard
someone. No, he didn't go to college.
Oh,
he didn't go to college.
Oh, okay. So, like, when you graduate with honors, you can graduate with what's called magna cum laude. And
skipped right into med school.
Yeah. So honors is just cum laude with honors. Or if you get like the next level, it's magna cum laude. So it's with, you know,
great
honor. And then summa cum laude is highest honor. So that's, like, in the Western university system, that's the Latin name for it.
Yeah.
So it's a good example of, you know, filling your specifiers with prepositional specifiers.
What's the last word? Laude?
Laude. Praise.
Laudatory.
Yeah, laudatory. Okay.
Yeah. Applause.
Wow.
That's another example. So, yeah, this is, Latin uses this very productively. I think I have, I'll only have that one. Prepositional example, but that's one of the first things you have to learn about Latin, because it's a little weird when you deal with that, but there we go. So, yeah, got your, I even put some traces there, you know.
Covering it to text basically.
Yeah, I would have put movement arrows, but I didn't have enough.
Probe down.
get some probing.
Probing
for peepee.
Cool.
Okay.
Oh,
So 19 has another example. So you have the word for if, and you have festo die, which is part of this CP, somewhere in the clause.
I like the glossing as splurge.
Yeah. So festo die can be front. So you know, originally you have festo die somewhere in the clause, somewhere after C, but it can be sort of topicalized or put up at the front. Mm-hmm. So holiday, if some you splurge. Well, I guess it can't really translate that in English. Okay. Look at the English examples because English still preserves some of this. So in 21, intelligent though you are, you fail to see this.
Yeah.
So intelligent is, you know, comes from, of course, though you are intelligent, you fail to see this. But English has this sort of archaic construction where you can move adjectives up and stuff like that. So that's similar to what's going on in Latin. And, you know, the good old minstrel song, what is it? Going to Louisiana. What's the name of that song?
I don't actually know.
Okay.
Oh, Susanna?
Oh, Susanna, yeah.
Oh,
Susanna?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a goofy song. It's fake English. It's supposed to imitate black English at the time, so, like, you know, there's some things that are sort of weird or marginal. Yep, problematic on multiple levels. But anyway, this has a good example of movement to spec CP. I'm going to Louisiana, my true love, for to C. So for functions as C in this construction, and you can front my true love.
Gotcha.
And then in 20, you have an example of an entire, you know, a bunch of stuff that isn't even necessarily a constituent. This is crazy shit. This constituent even exists. Perfida et peculatus ex urbe ex auritia. So ex urbe is its own preposition inside of this other constituent, and the whole thing has been fronted. And of course, all of it is before the C, the complementizer. So I provide Latin examples here, but it happens in other Indo-European languages as well. You have all this fronting of topics or other, you know, discursively important things in front of C's, in front of P's, in front of all these functional things. So that's pretty cool. And of course, you have, you know, similar stuff in modern German, right? You have B2. It's actually worth noting. So Hawk talks about all this, you know, changement to change. So Hawk, who's the guy who came up with the you know, SOV to SVO stuff that we just talked about in Germanic, he notes that generally when languages are more conservative in more marginal parts, so German preserves this older SOV word order in subordinated clauses in the less primary parts. And that's just and the last section. A lot. Just bear with me.
Sure.
The last part is what's called absolute constructions, and these are everywhere. You guys might have heard of them. You can look at an English example in 23, sort of. So all the group assembled, we began our trek to the convenience store. So all the group assembled is sort of a sentential modifier that it establishes either a precondition or some kind of description of the situation. Yes.
Which is actually an example.
Yeah, so
yeah,
this...
With
yeah.
this being the case, this
yeah. So in different Indo-European languages, this is one of the most productive Indo-European constructions. And in languages with case, which is all of them except for English, you know, basically, the absolutive constructions are governed by particular cases. So Latin is the most... Because everyone takes Latin. I know. But, you know, the first one people learn about is, in Latin, you have ablative absolutives, which is what you have in 26. So, ex putnatis or bibis, that is, both of those are ablative marked, Kaiser statuit. So, those towns taken, you know, comma, Caesar decided, you know,
know, so once those towns had been taken, once, you know, different ways of construing that. And you can see Greek and Sanskrit examples in 24 and 25. So when water is heated, foam arises in 25. So you have water and heated in the genitive case, and then that's intentionally modifying. Yeah, so foam is just the normal subject of the sentence. And same in Greek. So the men fighting, the women stay are in the home. I don't know why I guess that is a word that should be are. So Greek it's genitive. Sanskrit I have genitive here, but I think usually it's in locative in Sanskrit. And you can actually get some accusative absolutives in late Latin and stuff like that. But the absolute constructions are all over the place in late Indo-European languages. And keep in mind, I didn't put this here, but Indo-European is basically like pure aha. You know, there's no recursion. I was going to talk about relative clauses because they're worth looking at because they don't exist, basically. They're totally... I put a section heading there and there's nothing else. I was going to put relative clauses because they're interesting to look at because they don't exist, sort of. And I wanted to talk about impersonal modals, but we've talked about enough. And I made this handout like an hour ago, so. If any of you guys want to check my Avestan, I'm sure you'll find it. So, yeah. Well, sorry for keeping you guys.
Old man stuff. I was praying for the works of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit doesn't sound Zoroastrian to me.
Yeah, well, I didn't. That's not my translation. It's someone else's.
It's not the capital H of Holy Spirit.
I think it is.
It's just a spirit that just happens to be holy.
Asked me to explain the Trinity to
her.
Like,
oh,
fuck.
That's what it
is. Well, I brought it on myself because, like.
Did you know with who?
This Muslim girl.
So, did you pull up the Athanasian Creed and just read it?
Well, the thing is, it was my fault. I brought it on myself because I was talking about religion too much. I'm the kind of guy who just talks about weird fucking things.
Well, what's wrong with it? You could just explain it to her. She would just not like it.
It's a very difficult concept.
Well, no, I told her, I was talking about, she wanted to know about the difference between Catholics and Protestants. And I was talking about how much I don't like Catholics. I'm an atheist myself, but, you know, like, actually when I became an atheist, I became more staunchly Protestant, you know what I mean? Like, I simply care about all these disputes that Protestants and Catholics have. But, I was talking about all this shit, so she's like, so can you explain the Trinity to me? And I was just like, oh, no, don't worry, it doesn't make sense. Like, it doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't it exist in Protestant?
Yes.
Yeah, in
all canonical forms of Christianity.
Yeah, Mormons don't do it.
So why does it have to do with the Protestant-Catholic distinction?
Oh, well, she wanted to change subjects because she wanted to know about the Trinity.
Nice.
Like, I mean, the thing is, the Trinity didn't even exist in, like, first century Christianity. It's like, you know, I guess it was Augustine who sort of named the idea. Because, you know, people are always trying to grapple with, like, oh, is Christ divine? What are we supposed to say? What's his relationship with God? Blah, blah, blah. So the Trinity is a half-ass answer to that.
Yeah.
There's actually, anyone ever heard of Christoph Luxemburg?
I don't think so.
What do Muslims think about him, actually?
Well, of course they don't like him, I think. What else could you...
So Christoph Luxemburg is this guy... Well, it's not his real name.
He doesn't exist. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, he's anonymous because he works in Quranic exegesis, which, I mean, like, textual analysis of the Quran and stuff. His theory is basically that Islam originated as sort of a heterodox Syriac group of Christians that were basically disgusted by things like the Trinity. and they went off and sort of founded their own, you know, religion effectively. And, I mean, I've read his stuff, and it's hard to read because it's, you have to know, like, Arabic and Syriac.
Languages.
And, yeah, he doesn't gloss anything.
Oh.
Like, you have to know.
As you can see from this example.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's okay, interesting stuff. I can't opine on it. But.
I was very interested in it in the beginning,
yeah.
But it just found it to be, honestly, wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I liked it to be true, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't. I mean, I read what was the name of the book? The Syriac Reading of the Quran?
Yeah,
something
yeah.
Like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's his big thing. Yeah,
and he talks about a lot of the Quranic verses. He rewrites them in Syriac, and then he says, now let's imagine we have this Syriac sentence. How else can we read it? And he proposes that, okay, you can just change the position of the dots, which are not really that clear, and then you will have this other reading of this sentence, which makes much more sense in this context of like this surah in the Quran. But the problem is, well, I liked it, but then I tried to be more like accurate about the exact cases it was talking about. It didn't make a lot of sense.
The gist of it was that like in early writing you wouldn't have, you know, a lot of diacritics or dots.
Oh, so you write without the vowels, but if you go back and put the vowels in.
I mean, not just the vowels, mind you. Like, the differences between, like, you know, like, ta and ba and tha. You know, they're distinct by dots. Those weren't necessarily always written at certain periods. So, I mean, which is crazy, because how the fuck could someone ever communicate in a language like that? But, basically, his methodology is he takes a bunch of passages in the Quran that, like, sort of have questionable meaning, like, no one really, like, it's debated what they mean, and he says, ah, well, if you read them as Syriac, you know, the...
Yeah, I remember one of his examples. It's the surah in the Quran that is about Mary. So, it says... Wajalna is we put, tahtaka is under you, sariya is a, like,
yeah.
Well, stream, something like that. It's in the part that is talking about Mary giving birth to Jesus, and like she was having a lot of pain, and God wanted to be, like, make her a little happy, so there you go, here is this water, and there you go, here's this palm, you can have some dates to feel a little better. So, he says, rewrite this in Syriac, which is not very different from Arabic, by the way. And you can go like this, just changing the dots. And what you get is, وَجَعَلْنَا نَحْتَكَ شَرِيَةً, which is, we made your pregnancy lawful, even though like it was originally unlawful. And I liked it. It was cool. But the problem is, I looked around, and apparently, not is not exactly pregnancy in Syriac. It's mostly like it's more like it means just like to put down.
Yeah.
And it does figuratively mean to give birth.
Yeah.
But giving birth, making the actual act of labor. Lawful is less meaningful than the pregnancy itself being lawful.
Yeah.
And the other problem is that this story about the well, the water well, it's not just in Islamic tradition. You can find it in the I think you can find it either in directly in the Torah or somewhere in Judaic.
Yeah, I think there are some later Christian. I mean, well, one of the things I don't like about his analysis is that he gets rid of things that could be explained better, and I think this is one of them. Because I think there is like an infancy gospel of Jesus that was written maybe around 200 that has like Mary giving birth and then, you know, God making a little stream or something like that. So it seems like, you know, why would you throw that? I mean, there are other things. I think there's...
Yeah, and especially it fits really well in the context in that sort of... Afterward,
verse in the Quran is about the palm date.
Yeah.
And before that, it's about the pain. It's really just that story. Why do you need to change it?
Yeah. Yeah. But.
But still, I found the idea interesting.
Well, it's a shame there's not much work done on the Quran like there is on the Bible. You know, the thing about the Bible is like the entire Pentateuch, people have gone through and decided what was written by who and when and what was their, you know, vision, or like which of the letters of Paul are like actually written by Paul, which ones are bullshit, when were the Gospels written, where did the Gospels take from the other Gospels, you know, like everything is so intimately known. And then
about the Quran, I think there is some consensus that it was actually written during that time.
Well, that's true. Well, the thing about the Quran, but you also have things like, so in the Quran, there's the story where Jesus makes like little clay doves or something like that,
mm-hmm.
right? And you know, someone comes up and they're like, "Oh, stop fucking around, Jesus!" And Jesus like claps or something, and they fly away,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. So that, even if that was written at the time, we know that that story originated around 300 or something. It was another infancy gospel. It didn't make it into the real Bible, but it was written a couple years after. And, you know, even if the Quran was written at the same time, if it's still taking bits and pieces from different things, you can still do, like, a useful, I don't know, sort of an informative analysis of it.
I think there are good analyses. Do you know Goldseher?
No, I haven't.
He's a German Orientalist, the classical.
Orientalist.
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
I think it's just the English gold, and then...
Gold sealer?
Zeher.
Zeher. Oh, so S-E-H-E-R. Zeher.
He's so much hated and at the same time loved by like Muslim scholars, because he's great. He knows about Islam more than any Muslim scholar.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he has these ideas that makes them
see that?
And some of them are translated into Persian and Arabic, but not into English. That is so weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with shit written on the Bible. They all write in German, even until today. They still, I don't know.
But it's really valuable. These kinds of work, they're deep.
Yeah.
And they have all these ideas of, like, Muhammad, how might have he gotten the ideas that he's gotten.
Yeah.
Probably some Egyptian,
yeah.
Christian traditions.
I'll have to look them up. I've never heard of them. Well, that's Indo European for you.
Yep.
All right. Not very Indo European to us,
yeah.
But.
Yeah. Historical linguistics is plausibly done. That is. Historical linguistics is fundamental in dating the Bible. That's why we know Daniel wasn't actually written by Daniel, you know. All those Greek loanwords, they give it away.
Now, this is very interesting.
Yeah.
See, this is an alternative.
Yeah.
Reading of the Quran.
Oh, everything's heresy.